You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
The wealthy of the world have between $21 and $32 trillion of hidden financial assets. They hide these assets around the world in what are known as offshore accounts or tax havens. The money has been invested virtually tax-free through the world's black hole of more than 80 offshore secret jurisdictions. These are some of the findings of a recent report commissioned by the Tax Justice Network. The report is called The Price of Offshore Revisited. To talk about the implications of the report, we're joined by its author, James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and board member of the Tax Justice Network, and he joins me this morning. Hello, James.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. Now, $21 to $32 trillion, that's a pretty big number. What were the key findings of your study?
Well, first of all, I think the size of this has not been quantified before in this kind of detail. We spent 18 months looking at three different measures of the number so that we can feel confident in this. It's collectively about 10 to 15% of world wealth. We're only looking at financial assets, not non-financial assets like real estate or art collections or yachts, which are also to a large extent, to a great extent, surprising extent, held offshore or through offshore companies. So we feel this number is actually pretty conservative. The most important thing about it is that this almost all of this wealth accrues to the top 0.1% of the income distribution worldwide. So it'll have a big impact on our measures of inequality. It also has a tremendous impact on the developing world because of low and middle income countries account for between 7 and 9 trillion of the 21 trillion total. And so from the standpoint of overall economic development, it's having a big impact on their finances. And I guess the final thing to emphasize is that about 12.3 trillion of this is held by the top 50 banks that are specialized in haven banking. And, you know, many of them are ones that we're familiar with from the banking crisis, players like UBS, Credit Suisse, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank America. These are among the largest banks in the world, and they have specialized in so-called international private banking, which amounts to helping the world's wealthiest people move their money offshore and invest it tax-free.
Well, let's talk about that. What mechanisms have they've been using to do that?
Well, the main mechanisms are have been offshore companies, you know, a Cayman Island company or a BVI, or, you know, there's about 80 secrecy jurisdictions that provide those shell companies, including some onshore like Delaware and Nevada in the United States. This whole activity has been exploding. And then there are also offshore trusts, which are quite important. So as the level of wealth increases, the number of layers increases, and the sophistication of the sort of asset protection of vehicles also increases. But they're basically, you know, a few simple holding vehicles that are used to get the money to the ultimate destinations. Nobody's really parking their money in, you know, their financial money in tiny islands offshore. They're ultimately investing it in the world's largest financial centers like New York and London and Geneva, Zurich. So those so-called destination capitals are the places that the money actually ends up being invested in stocks and bonds and bank deposits. But the intermediate havens, these conduit havens like the Caymans and BVI, are kind of you know, get most of the attention when we talk about you know, offshore havens. But the true havens are the big countries that have designed this whole system, whose banks are basically operating it.
Now, you mentioned earlier quite a large figure. I think it was $12.5 trillion dollars was from developing countries. So, how have the banks facilitated the movement of capitals from countries, say, in Latin America or Africa?
Well, this activity goes back a long time. You know, I've been studying this since the 1980s, and one of the first articles I did for the New Republic was a cover story that talked about how Citibank had basically, you know, gotten the reputation of lending a lot to Latin America during that period, but basically they set up a international private banking department to help wealthy Latin Americans take their money out of Latin America at the same time that they were lending to it. I found a similar thing in many other countries around the planet. In the case of the Philippines, you know, the banks were lending to the Philippine Central Bank, and Ferdinand Marcos was using it as his kind of personal piggy bank, just transferring the money offshore, more than $7 billion that he transferred to his Swiss private accounts. And this was money that the Philippine government had basically borrowed and is still actually servicing. So, you know, there's a clear case of where the banks were facilitating this kind of round-tripping. More usually, it's a case that you have ordinary tax evaders or wealthy folks who are just taking their own money out at the same time, you know, and with the help of the banks, and ultimately it's ending up in havens where it's not reported to the home country.
I understand that even though Nigeria is a debtor country, they have a lot of unrecorded capital flowing out of that country.
Well, that's true of many developing countries. In fact, for the low and middle income countries as a whole, they have about, as of year end 2010, about $4 trillion of gross debt outstanding, but they also have all this, we estimated 7.3 to 9.3 trillion just from the developing countries that's offshore. And then they have another $6 trillion of official assets that are official reserves that are sitting offshore, mainly invested in things like U.S. Treasury bills. So when you add all that up, it means that the poorest countries on the planet, low and middle income countries, are net lenders to the richest 34 countries, the OECD countries, where this capital ends up, to the tune of about $11 trillion as of the end of 2010. And on an individual country level, you find, you know, Mexico and Brazil and Argentina, Nigeria, as you mentioned, Russia. These are all actually, when you add up the value of these offshore assets and their reserves, they are net lenders, not debtor countries at all. So the problem they have is not really a debt problem. It's a fact that it's a problem of taxation. Developing countries have a hard time taxing this money once it's flown outside the country.
James, why should the average person, say a person in Canada or the United States, why should they care about this?
Well, first of all, it's coming back to haunt our own government revenue collection. You know, the U.S. Treasury has recently gotten upset at the Swiss banks that have been coming to the United States and getting wealthy Americans to move their money offshore. And, you know, we've had the case of the presidential candidate Romney, who's got offshore accounts and won't disclose what he was doing before 2010. You know, so there are a lot of Romneys in the world. The effect on the rest of us is that if capital and income become so mobile that they can't be taxed, then the rest of us end up paying for the essential costs of government services like health and education and police and fire, and, you know, we end up with sales taxes or excise taxes, very regressive taxes that can't be shifted. And that's what's actually been going on all over Latin America, where they've had this problem for years. I was just in Brazil. There, the top 10% of the population pays a lower share of government costs than the bottom half of the population, and that's because they rely heavily on VAT taxes and sales taxes rather than income taxes or capital taxes on capital, because, you know, it's too easy for the rich to move the money to these offshore havens.
Now, one of the arguments in favor of tax cuts is that they'll stimulate the economy because corporations and wealthy individuals will spend more. Do you think that your findings undermine that argument?
I think so. I mean, I think what we've seen in the last 30 years is a continuous series ever since the Reagan period of the 1980s, certainly in the United States, but also, you know, really all over the globe, kind of tax competition going on among countries, and steady reductions in corporate and personal income tax rates at the top level. You know, the United States rate is still nominally 35%, but nobody pays that rate. The effective rate on corporations, many corporations, has been zero in the last few years. So we've seen, ironically enough, the explosion of this offshore activity has gone on even while we've been cutting tax rates since the 1980s. So it can't, that can't explain, you know, high tax rates doesn't explain this activity. What explains this activity is the growth of this, of globalization and of this global industry that's made it easier and easier for people to move their money offshore and not and hide it. And, you know, that's basically the function of the largest banks in the world and their use of these havens. In 1970, there were only about 15 offshore havens that amounted to anything. Now there's more than 80. And the world's largest banks, accounting firms, and law firms are deeply involved in assisting with all this activity.
Can you give us some idea of the kind of people who are using tax havens?
Well, you have one example, unnamed, is a fellow who's essentially arranged his affairs to be a citizen of nowhere for tax purposes. Has the house in Geneva, the house on the coast of France, the house in the Park Avenue apartment. He carefully arranges a lifestyle. He's worth more than $1 billion. He's taxable nowhere because he invests in, for example, U.S. Treasuries. If you are a non-resident alien and you live in the United States less than 180 days a year, the United States Treasury doesn't tax your interest earnings on those bonds. So there are collectively about 120,000 people who are, we estimate, are worth more than $30 million apiece in the world as a whole, and are able to take advantage of the sophisticated mechanisms for reducing taxes on everything but, you know, the sales taxes that they can't avoid. The City of London, for example, is renowned for doing tax deals with so-called non-doms, who are able to live there essentially tax-free, and all their real estate is held offshore. All their earnings flow through offshore companies in islands like Jersey and Guernsey. And essentially, the only benefit for the City of London is higher real estate prices.
James, in your report, you indicate one difficulty in getting information was official government policies that protect tax havens. Can you talk about that and the role of those policies to protect the
tax havens? The United States, for example, has this tax policy, which basically encourages this activity. As I said, if you're a wealthy Mexican and you have your money at Citibank in New York and invested in bank deposits or in U.S. bonds, the U.S. Treasury doesn't collect any information on your earnings, and it doesn't share, doesn't collect any information that's willing to share with Mexico. We do share information with a select few of wealthy countries like Canada and the U.K., but for most of the developing countries where much of this capital comes from, there is no such automatic information exchange, and that's one of the policies we're trying to encourage. By the way, I might mention that the report is freely available on the Internet by now. It's called The Price of Offshore Revisited, and it's at the tjn-us.org website for anybody to download it and read it. I think one of the basic things we need to do is educate ourselves about this, the way this global economy is really working.
And then how do we stem this tide of money going to tax havens?
Well, one of the big issues is that a lot of the tax, a lot of the capital has already flown the coop and is not coming back. And, I think, the unreported earnings on this offshore capital that's already there is substantial enough to almost displace the fresh capital flight. Countries like Brazil have made a lot of economic progress, and so you don't see the fresh outflows that you used to. But I think one thing that we can do is to have the kind of automatic information exchange that I talked about among tax authorities. The second is the regulation of these big banks, pirate banking, this activity of taking money out of home countries and helping to shelter it tax-free is really enabling invasion on a massive scale. Requires us to crack down on the banks that are engaged in that, like HSBC and UBS and the big American banks. I think there are also some Canadian banks I might mention as well that have been pioneers in this activity. I mean, one of the founding fathers of the Caribbean haven system was Royal Bank of Canada, there are a few innocent parties to be had here. But I think the other thing we might consider is a simple kind of this would require global cooperation. A simple withholding tax on all this dirty money that's already offshore. 0.1% tax or a 0.5% tax would be substantial enough to generate enough to pay for all the aid budgets or for climate change or, you know, the development of vaccines for AIDS. A lot of the collective expenditures that we really have as a planet to take care of the poorest people in the world are just going, you know, begging right now because of the crisis in finance all over the planet. I think we should consider a tax on anonymous flight capital and on all this wealth that is sitting in offshore banks, because it would be easy for these 50 banks to just levy a withholding tax like that on the assets that they have under management.
Well, I'm going to have to leave it there, James, but it's been really interesting, and thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Good. Quite welcome.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
We've been speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and board member of the Tax Justice Network, and you can read the report at The Price of Offshore Revisited, and that's at taxjustice.net. And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. On September 11th, CFRO will be moving to 100.5, so get ready for that, and please follow us there.